The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I am going to speak to you this morning on the subject of man in the image of God. It is quite important that the subject should be stated in these terms. It has frequently been stated in terms of the image of God in man. That is not accurate, and I don't believe it creates the right impression. It is man in the image of God. That is the biblical way of stating it, and from that order, the Bible does not depart. The basic text, of course, in this connection is Genesis 1, 26 and 27, the relevant part of which reads as follows: "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And God created the man in his image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them." But to be coordinated with Genesis 1, 26 and 27 are Genesis 5, 1 through 3, Genesis 9, 6, 1 Corinthians 11, 7, and James 3, 9. Then later on we shall discuss the place of Ephesians 4, 24 and Colossians 3, 10, which are really in a distinct category. It would not be reasonable to draw an anthropological distinction between likeness and image, or image and likeness. In Genesis 1:26, the words "according to our likeness" are so coordinated with the words "in our image" that we should regard the words "according to our likeness" as explanatory of "in our image." And furthermore, there is the parallelism between Genesis 1, 26 and 27 and Genesis 5, 1 through 3. Particularly Genesis 5, 1 and 2. And therefore the word likeness in Genesis 5, 1 and 2 is surely intended to express what is involved in both terms in Genesis 1, 26. Furthermore, in Genesis 1, 27, only image is used, as you would have noted in the quotation, and the proximity to Genesis 1, 26, where both image and likeness are used, would require us to regard image in Genesis 1, 27 as synonymous with the double formula in Genesis 1:26. Again, in Genesis 5:3, Adam is said to have begotten Seth in his likeness according to his image, a reversal of the order and construction followed in Genesis 1:26, but again suggesting definition rather than addition. Now, this does not mean that image and likeness can always be used interchangeably, especially in the New Testament. I don't believe it would be proper to use these interchangeably in certain contexts in the New Testament. For example, Christ is called the image of God on two occasions, but he is never said to be the likeness of God or in the likeness of God. The Greek term for image is eikon, and the Greek word for likeness is homoiosis or homoioma. However, Christ is said to be made in the likeness of men. He is not said to be in the image of men, but in the likeness of men, and made in the likeness of sinful flesh. And these, of course, are Philippians 2:7 and Romans 8:3, and then again in Hebrews 2:7, the verb, the corresponding verb is used when he is said to be made like unto his brethren in all things. So I take it that a theological or anthropological distinction between image and likeness in this particular connection is just pure fancy. A good deal of the older Roman Catholic theology had been based on that distinction, but I think there is no biblical evidence to support the distinction. The question is, what is this image of God in which man was created and made? As you know, on this question, much difference has arisen, and the difference still continues. The controversy is really unabated. The question can be focused in these words, is the image of God in which man was made something that man lost by the fall, or is it something that belongs inalienably to man and constitutes his definition? Does the scripture itself throw light on this issue? Now, in my judgment, there are four passages that are relevant to this particular question. And they are Genesis 5:3, Genesis 9:6, 1 Corinthians 11:7, and James 3:9. Now, we shall look first of all then at Genesis 5:3. Where, with reference to Seth, it is said, and Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his likeness according to his image. Now, it could be argued that a contrast is intended between the image in which Adam begat Seth, namely verse 3, and the likeness in which Adam was created, according to verse 1. Or it could be argued that there is at least no necessary identification of the likeness and image of verse 3 and the likeness of verse 1. And that the emphasis in verse 3, referring to Adam's begetting of a son, falls on Adam's likeness, whereas in verse 1, the emphasis falls upon God's likeness, in which Adam and Eve were created. So that all that verse 3 means is that Adam begat a son who resembled himself. Now that position has been taken, and there is a good deal of plausibility to it, but there are objections to that construction of Genesis 5:3. And the objections I would urge are these. First, Genesis 5:1 harks back surely to Genesis 1:26. There is no hint that a different conception of likeness and image is introduced at verse 3. And since chapter 5 deals with the book of the generations of Adam, every consideration would suggest that the purpose of reference to likeness and image in verse 3, where Adam's begetting of Seth is in view, is to show that Adam's progeny was to be defined in the same terms as those of Adam himself. In other words, that the identity characterized by the image of God was maintained in Adam's offspring. If you bear in mind the purpose of Genesis 5, this is the book of the generations of Adam, and then read verse 1, I think that the natural construction is really to that effect. Then a second consideration. In respect of image and likeness, as predicated of man, there does not appear to be evidence in Scripture that this predication has any other reference than that of God's image and likeness. Nowhere is there the distinction drawn between the image of God and the image of man by way of contrast or differentiation. And so to import such a contrast here in Genesis 5:3 would be contrary to the biblical pattern, to the general biblical pattern, that when the image is referred to, it is the image of God, unto man in the image of God. Now I know 1 Corinthians 15:49 could readily be pleaded to the contrary of that thesis I am propounding, where, as we have borne the image of the earthly, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly. And the word is used, which is used generally, of the image of God. Now, my argument here is that the contrast between the image of the earthly and the image of the heavenly is not between the image of God and the image of man in contradistinction, but between the image of Adam as the first man and the image of Christ, the second man and last Adam, as life-giving spirit. It is the potency that belongs to Christ in virtue of his resurrection and in virtue of his being the life-giving spirit that is the controlling thought in 1 Corinthians 15:49. That is the contrast between what Adam was as living soul, 1 Corinthians 15:45, harking back to Genesis 2:7, the contrast between what Adam was as living soul and Christ in the power of his resurrection, and that there is no reflection upon a more basic differentiation between the image of God and the image in which man was created. Then a third consideration for this view of Genesis 5:3 is that, as we shall find later on, man in his fallen state is regarded as in the image of God. And so there is no reason to posit a differentiation between the likeness and image of verse 3 and the likeness of verse 1, that is, in Genesis 5. Now, I know that is the thesis I'm trying to propound, but I'm mentioning this as a third consideration, that the other passages with which I shall deal presently has to be taken into account in dealing with Genesis 5:3, and it is not improper to make mention of the other passages which support this thesis as an argument in support of the construction I'm giving of Genesis 5:3. Now I come to Genesis 9:6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he the man. Or you may simply say, made he man. Now that law was instituted for man as fallen, and therefore has relevance for man as such. Of course, it could only apply to the fallen state of mankind, because only in the fallen state of mankind would there be such a thing as the shedding of man's blood. Now in this verse, there are three considerations. Genesis 9:6. First, the gravity of the offense of murder, that is, of willful, unjustifiable shedding of human blood. Second, the gravity of the penalty, by man his blood shall be shed. And then the reason for the latter infliction, that man was made in the image of God. Now, if man in his fallen state is not in the image of God, if that identity no longer belongs to him, then this fact that he was made originally in the image of God could not be the reason for the gravity of the penalty, nor for the gravity of the offense. It is precisely his being made in the image of God that is given as the reason for the penalty of capital punishment, and by implication for the gravity of the offense. The thought is, surely, that assault upon the life of man is a particularly heinous offense, and a heinous offense because it is an assault upon the image of God, and for that reason merits capital punishment. I would plead that the assumption is negated if man thus assaulted is not in the image of God. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God made he that is God, the man. Now I come to 1 Corinthians 11:7, where it is said that man is the image and glory of God. In this passage, as you remember, Paul is dealing with the decorum in respect of headgear to be observed by men and women in the exercises of praying and prophesying. Thus, presupposed in this passage is the Christian status of those concerned, and that is made perfectly clear by verse 3, 1 Corinthians 11:3. So I know it could be argued that this passage has no relevance to the question at issue, because the Christian status is presupposed, and therefore it is not dealing with man in his unredeemed state, and consequently is not pertinent to the issue with which we are now dealing. I think that is a very superficial view of the passage. We must recognize that implied in what governs the Christian relationship, and more specifically, the exercises of worship, is a more basic economy, that the man is the head of the woman, that the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Namely, 1 Corinthians 11:8, that the man was not created for the woman, but the woman for the man, 1 Corinthians 11:9. And Paul is applying this basic order to the decorum to be followed in specifically Christian activities, such as praying and prophesying. In other words, the creation ordinances are not abrogated in the state of sin, nor suspended in the Christian economy. So what underlies Paul's injunction respecting worship has relevance to man in all states, and the assertion that the man is the image and glory of God must likewise pertain to this basic economy that governs the relationships of the man and the woman. Now again, in 1 Corinthians 11:7, image, as predicated of man, is used in a more specialized sense. The image of God that the man is, as distinguished from the woman. It is the man specifically who is said to be the image and glory of God. But, nevertheless, the passage applies to our discussion in this respect. If, in the specialized sense, as applying to the man in distinction from the woman, if in the specialized sense the man is the image and glory of God, by reason of the unabrogated order of creation, then man's being in the image of God in the more generic sense, inclusive of the woman as well as the man, which is clearly indicated by Genesis 1:27b and Genesis 5:1 and 2, as well as the man, must likewise hold true as the basis of the more specialized predication applying to the man as distinct from the woman in 1 Corinthians 11:7. So again, you see, when you take into account the more basic and broader economy that is presupposed in 1 Corinthians 11:7, I do plead that 1 Corinthians 11:7 has relevance to the subject in debate. I come now to James 3:9. Therewith that is, with the tongue, therewith bless we the Lord and Father, and therewith curse we the men who are made after the similitude of God. The men who are made after the similitude of God. Now this occurs in an indictment of the tongue as an unruly evil full of deadly poison. James 3:8. Now surely this applies to all vilification of which the human tongue is the organ, and so the indiscriminate cursing with the tongue is surely in view. If so, then the statement, therewith curse we the men who are made after the similitude of God, applies without any differentiation. Applies to all cursing of men without any distinction. Now in that event, men without distinction are said to be made after the likeness of God. In view of the inclusive scope of the indictment, therefore, it would be arbitrary to interpret the clause, who are made after the likeness of God, to interpret that restrictively, as if it referred simply to the men who are made after the image of God, namely the godly, in distinction from others, the ungodly, who are not made after God's image. And so I submit that James 3:9, in view of the general character of the indictment in the context, has relevance to our subject, and that it is the assumption upon which the inspired writer proceeded that men are made after the likeness of God. And that is why it is such a grievous offense to indulge in vilification, in cursing. Now, these passages, these four passages, though not all with equal clarity, are based, I plead, on the assumption that man as man is made in the divine image, and that as men are propagated, there is the perpetuation of that identity expressed in Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 5:1. But there is also another consideration, not based so much on any one particular text, but based on more general considerations. The origin and nature of man are sharply distinguished from other animate beings as made after their kind. Genesis 1:24 and 25, as I mentioned the other day, reiterates that most eloquently. On five occasions, other beings are made after their kind or to their kind. And there is the sharp contrast between that and man as made after the image and likeness of God. The basic differentiation resides in that contrast. The divine image defines the distinct identity of man, and the fall does not obliterate this radical differentiation between man and all other animate beings, nor does it destroy man's distinguishing identity. The whole subsequent history of revelation, and particularly the history of redemption, bear out that principle that the fall, however serious it was, does not obliterate man's distinguishing identity, the distinguishing identity which is so eloquently drawn to our attention in Genesis 1:26, in contrast with Genesis 1:24 and 25. Quality must also be continued. And that conclusion accords with what is true in the case of the creation ordinances, the other creation ordinances. These are not abrogated, and neither is man's identity as made in the image of God. That consideration, derived from Genesis 1:26, is to my mind the most weighty of all, and in the total structure of the biblical revelation, it is borne out by these other references in which man in the image of God is assumed as the premise of the thought respecting man even in his fallen state and in his unredeemed state. And it is in the perspective of that distinguishing identity so eloquently advertised in Genesis 1:26 that these other passages become so significant, because they, without any differentiation, carry on the thought that this distinguishing identity still belongs in man. And these other passages, like Genesis 5:3, Genesis 9:6, 1 Corinthians 11:7, James 3:9, are just based on that assumption. And that is what makes them all the more significant and all the more relevant to our discussion. Now, if we take this position that the image of God defines man in his specific character and identity, it would appear to be proper to try, at least, to analyze that in which this identity consists. I would refer in this connection to Calvin's Institutes, Book 1, Chapter 15, Paragraphs 3 and 4, in which you have a very significant discussion of this particular question. Man is a person, and therefore a self-conscious, rational, free, moral, and religious agent. We might focus attention upon these last two characterizations, that he is a moral and religious agent. I use the word moral in this discussion as referring to responsibility. Man lives and moves and has his being in the realm of ought, O-U-G-H-T, in the realm of duty, of obligation to be consciously and freely fulfilled. In this respect, man is never non-moral. There is no moment of his life, no situation in which he is non-moral. He is always under obligation to obey the will of God. Conscience, by which he accuses or excuses, is the proof of obligation respecting itself in his consciousness. Obligation in his consciousness. This responsibility now is based upon what God is. God is justice. Compare Deuteronomy 32:4, 1 John 1:5. God is justice. God, of course, is spirit. God is light. God is love. God is a consuming fire. But the inference of these passages I just cited is that God is justice. and this is reflected in the being of man. The ultimate criterion of obligation for man is likeness to God. Likeness to God in the sense in which that has application to man as created. The law of God, which regulates man's conduct, is God's perfection coming to expression for the regulation of thought, word, and action consonant with that perfection. Now, with the criterion of behavior, that is the ultimate criterion of behavior, is likeness to God. It is because to man belongs a likeness to God that makes it possible for him to have his life and conduct patterned after the exemplar which the attitude and actions of God provide. That is, an intrinsic affinity. Depraved indeed and perverted by the fall, yet not obliterated, because it is the ground of obligation. And if you remove that ground of obligation, you remove the obligation itself. To sum up, it is the metaphysical likeness to God that grounds obligation, and the fulfillment of obligation consists in conformity to the image of God. Now let us focus for one moment attention upon the word religious in the definition of man. The term religious points to the most intimate relation which man sustains to God. Only in God can he find satisfaction. Only in the fellowship of God can the aspirations of his soul be realized. And that is the basic implication of his being religious. Now it has been felt that to posit man as fallen to be in the image of God impinges upon the doctrine of total depravity. That is a position that has been taken more recently by the man whom I consider to be the most erudite in the Reformed family, G.C. Berkauer of Amsterdam. That to posit man as fallen in the image of God impinges upon the doctrine of total depravity. That it supposes the retention by fallen man of what is intrinsically good, a good that needs no more than to be fanned into exercise. Now, on the contrary, it appears to me that thinking should proceed in the opposite direction. If our analysis is correct, that the divine image defines man in his specific character as man, then sin is intensified in its heinousness for the very reason that his identity is to be defined in such dignified terms. The higher is our conception of man in his intrinsic being, the greater must be the gravity of his offense in rebellion and enmity against God. If we think of depravity as enmity against God, which I think is proper, the more aggravated must be that enmity when it is man in the image of God who vents it, and the more total must be that depravity when a being of such character is the subject of it. In a word, the greater is the potentiality for sin, the more aggravated and virulent will be its exercise. Man conceived of as in the image of God, therefore, so far from toning down the doctrine of total depravity, points rather to its gravity, intensity, and irreversibility. Finally, it is the fact that man is in the image of God that constitutes the unspeakable horror of eternal perdition. Now, if we conceive of the image of God as inalienable, or of man as in the image of God as inalienable, we are not to underestimate the impairment resulting from the fall, or the impairment involved in total depravity. Man's personality is distorted, and he is depraved in his whole being. A person is never in the proper exercise of those attributes that define personality, except as he exercises those attributes in the whole soul's love and service of God. Man is characterized in his fallen state by understanding, feeling, will, and conscience. But his understanding is darkened, his emotions are perverted, his will is enslaved, and his conscience distorted. He is mind, but it is carnal, and enmity against God. And as noted above, it is the dignity belonging to man as in the image of God that aggravates this depravity, And when we think of man as metaphysically and inalienably in the image of God, we can never conceive of what he metaphysically is apart from the moral and religious relations that pertain to him by reason of what he intrinsically is. We can never, in other words, think of the metaphysical apart from the moral and religious. Now, up to this point in my discussion, the accent has fallen upon man on the psychical aspect of his being. The question arises, is it only in respect of his being spirit that man is made in the image of God? Now, it would be easy to say so. God has no body. And therefore, how could man as body come within the scope of the divine image or likeness? However, it is man in his unity and integrity who is made in the image of God. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, Genesis 2, 7, Genesis 9, 6. Man is body, and it is not possible to exclude man in his identity from the scope, man in this identity from the scope of that which defines his identity, namely the image of God. Sin and holiness are predicated of the body. The body is a sinful body. It is a body of sin. And man yields his members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin. Now, I don't believe that these predications or that these indictments could belong to man unless the body comes within the scope of that definition which man is. Now, this does not mean that God has a body. Not at all. There is a radical difference between God and man, even in respect of spirit. a radical difference between saying God is spirit and man is spirit. And the greater difference in respect of body is but an extension of that differentiation. Man's body and its functions are subject to moral judgment by way of approbation or censure. And only by virtue of responsibility could that be so. And the main consideration is that of man in his integrity is God's image predicated, and we could not think of man as mentioned in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, Genesis 2, 7, but as man in his integrity. Genesis 1, 26 says, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. And then Genesis 2, 7 tells us how. And the Lord God formed the man, dust from the ground, breathed in his nostrils the breath of life. Man became living creature. And therefore, you cannot abstract any element of what man is, according to Genesis 2:7, from the predication of Genesis 1:26, namely, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Now here we come to another phase of the whole question of man in the image of God. And this phase must not by any means be discounted. I mentioned at the beginning Ephesians 4:24 and Colossians 3:10 as belonging to a distinct category of passages pertaining to the issue. Now in these two passages, when put together, the image of God is defined in terms of knowledge, righteousness, and holiness of the truth. That is, when both are put together, that is the precipitate that man is that the image of God is defined in these terms. Now it cannot be questioned, but it is the new man who is in view in both passages, the man created anew in Christ Jesus. Consequently, they do not expressly refer to Adam as created, and by no means do they refer to man unregenerate. The person who is in view is the new man. The only question, therefore, is, do these passages refer by implication to Adam in his original integrity? There can be no question but Adam was created upright. He was very good, according to Genesis 1:31, and therefore very good in terms of his being and function. He could not be upright and good in terms of what he essentially was unless he had knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. Therefore, if Adam was created in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, and if God's image is defined in these terms, the inference would appear to be necessary that Adam was created in the image of God in respect of these qualities, knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. Furthermore, as Calvin argues, that which holds the first place in the renovation of man must have held the first place in the first creation. That is the position in those paragraphs I already cited. Finally, it is difficult to exclude from these two passages an allusion to Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 5:1, after the image of him that created it. If this position is maintained, that Ephesians 4:24 and Colossians 3:10 have a reference to Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 5:1, then we should have to construe the image of God as predicated of man in terms of a twofold aspect. One that's intrinsic and then losable, and the other as forfeited in the fall. Now that is the classic Reformed position, as markedly distinct from the classic Lutheran position, and of course also as markedly distinct from the Roman Catholic position. The distinction between the two aspects has been made in various ways, and it could still be made in various terms. For example, the distinction between moral agency and moral excellence, the distinction between the image in the more generic sense and the image in the more specific sense, the distinction between image in the metaphysical sense and image in the ethical sense. The distinction could be made in such terms, although none of these terms are thoroughly satisfactory. And I think you could have noted that from my preceding discussion, because for example, the metaphysical and the ethical can never be fully separated as far as man is concerned. And therefore, to make this distinction in terms of the distinction between the metaphysical and the ethical is not completely watertight. It should be understood, however, that the doctrine of man's original integrity, that he was created with positively holy and upright character, that this character was not a superadded gift, nor a later self-developed acquisition, but a concreated endowment, is not indispensably based on the premise that knowledge, righteousness, and holiness is included in the image and likeness of Genesis 1:26. Now, I think it's all important to have that clearly understood, that the doctrine of man's original integrity, as maintained in the classic Reformed theology, or, for that matter, even in classic Lutheran theology, is not indispensably based on the premise that knowledge, righteousness, and holiness is included in the image and likeness referred to in Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 5:1. In other words, that premise respecting the image of God is not indispensable to the doctrine of original integrity. Now, it will have to be granted that the thesis of a twofold aspect derived from or based upon these two passages, Ephesians 4:24, Colossians 3:10, when coordinated with the other passages I discussed earlier, is not as conclusive as it might appear to be. Now, this is simply my own hesitation. I may be wrong, The thought that I have developed just a few minutes ago respecting the double aspect may be the necessary construction. And I cannot be dogmatic. All I am saying is that the thesis of a twofold aspect is not as conclusive as it might appear to be. Recreation is undoubtedly after God's image in the respects specified in Ephesians 4:24, Colossians 3:10. But that is intended in Genesis 1:26 and other passages is not necessarily the case. In the context of Genesis 1:26, it is the nature and dignity of man in contradistinction from all other animate creatures that are being emphasized. It is man's specific character that is thrown into prominence. And it may well be that it is this identity that is intended and not the moral and religious excellence with which man was also endowed. Genesis 5:1, for example, is dealing with the history of mankind fallen. It is the book of the generations of Adam. May I say it again? Genesis 5:1 is dealing with the history of mankind fallen. But there is no intimation that so radical a change had taken place in the content of the image of God as would be the case if knowledge, righteousness, and holiness were construed as ingredients of what was comprised in the image and likeness of Genesis 1:26 and the likeness of Genesis 5:1. So the upshot of these considerations would appear, therefore, to me to be that as far as man in the image of God is concerned, after the pattern of Genesis 1:26, 5:1, 9:6, 1 Corinthians 11:7, James 3:9, and compare also Genesis 5:3. No more may be in view than that which belongs to man as man and may not comprise the moral excellence referred to in Ephesians 4:24 and Colossians 3:10. Now in conclusion, before we recess, just a word about dominion over the creatures. Some Reformed theologians regard this dominion as an element in the image of God. It would appear preferable, however, to regard dominion as a function or office based upon the specific character defined as the image of God. In other words, the image of God fits him or the dominion to be exercised. Man is made in God's image. He is therefore constituted God's vicegerent. It belongs to God's being to be sovereign over all creation. It belongs to man's being to execute delegated sovereignty. No theological issue is at stake in this matter. No basic theological issue, if you wish to include dominion over the creatures in that which is stated to be the divine image. But nevertheless, I don't think it is the most reasonable construction. Psalm 8 is the echo of Genesis 1:26 and 27. It is not the insignificance of man, that is the theme of Psalm 8, but the amazing dignity bestowed upon him. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. And that is confirmed by the application of Psalm 8 in Hebrews 2:5-9.